This episode discusses crime scenes. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. When we began work on the case of Brian Worley, who disappeared in Carrollton, Georgia in 2009, we started where we always do, connecting with a family, filing Freedom of Information Act requests, contacting law enforcement. When we gained access to some of the files associated with Brian's case, one of the first things we noticed was that in 2015, Trace Sargent had aided in a search of the family property. Now, we knew her name. She's the top canine search and rescue specialist in our state, Georgia, and one of the most respected and experienced experts in the country. Trace has worked on many cases in the Southeast and beyond, from search and rescue during natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina, to searches for human remains and missing persons and suspected homicide cases. She's searched for Chase Masner, Natalie Holloway, Dior Coons, and dozens of people you've probably heard of. But Trace Sargent, she searches for everyone. Her focus remains on families, not how high-profile the case is. They're who she thinks of each time she begins a new search, whether it's for a child or elder that's been missing hours, or a loved one missing for 10 years. We were lucky enough to sit down with Trace this summer and talk to her about all things canine, how she found the field, how she trains her dogs, how the scenting process works, how cases have affected her. There was a lot. We think you'll enjoy hearing what she has to say because it's absolutely fascinating. Trace, you have a resume that is very long and very impressive. If you had to sum up what you do in a sentence, what would you say?
Laura, I would say, and what most people know me for, is missing person cases. In essence, I find missing persons both dead and alive in all kinds of situations.
And I think that's how our audience might know you. You've worked on a number of high-profile cases and appeared on TV. I know you worked the case of Chase Masner and on the second search for Natalie Holloway. But you take all kinds of cases, natural disasters, missing persons, homicides, and more, both in the U.S. and abroad. How many cases have you worked since you began?
That's a really tough question to answer because over the years, there's so many that I've worked, I've kind of lost count, really. If I had to estimate, it's probably about 1,400 cases over the years. So I've been involved, as you said, in a vast array of searches over the years, and it's been really a privilege to help all kinds of families and officials in all kinds of situations, and they have been many over the years.
Did you set out to become a canine trainer and handler? How did you come to this work?
When people ask me about how I got involved in this and, you know, was it something that I dreamed about or thought about as a young child and my goals and aspirations, it's not an easy question to answer because it was more of an accidental journey with a lot of faith, a lot of trust, and a lot of unknowns that led me to where I am today. So let me take you back on how this started, and I'll give you the really short version of it. So way back when I was in college, I was working full-time and going to school full-time, and my life was really a blur. I knew when I finished college, I wanted to get a dog, and as a child, we always had family pets. So I really had a natural love and affection for dogs, but I really didn't have the clear understanding of what their capabilities are, meaning I never worked a working dog. I had never been around them as a child. So when I started this, and I say this kiddingly, but it's really not an exaggeration, I really didn't know what end of the dog barked when I started this endeavor. And what happened is I was sitting in bed, reading an article at a Reader's Digest. I still have that article today. And it was about a woman that had a German Shepherd that found a missing 3-year-old boy. Well, that really sparked a curiosity, planted a seed for me because I had just finished college. I did some research. I knew I wanted to get a dog, and I didn't know exactly what kind of dog. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do with it, but I wanted it to be more than just a companion or a pet. So in my research, I found that the German Shepherd breed was the perfect breed for me. We had never had German Shepherds before when I was growing up. And literally the first puppy that ran to me, that's the one I picked. So he was a few months old, and I knew that he wasn't going to be small forever. And I knew that he was going to be a big, strong dog. So I thought, well, I need to take him to some obedience classes, socialization classes. A friend of mine had told me about agility courses, and I did that a little bit, and it was just a really wonderful experience. Met some great people, learned a lot of things. But what happened, Laura, is that something was just really gnawing at me, that I wanted to do something different and special with this puppy, but I really just didn't have any idea. At that point, he was probably about a year old, and fate stepped in. And that fate was that article that I mentioned earlier in Reader's Digest. As I read this article, it really just sparked something in me that I can't explain. And it was, in essence, the seed, the motivation, the passion, the idea of, wow, if she can do it, I can do it. So that's how all of this started. So what led from there was I made a bunch of phone calls. And mind you, I was living in Alabama when all this started. So I was born and raised in Alabama. And I had heard a bunch of stories about different people doing these different things, but it always led back to a specific law enforcement officer. And I really have to give him a lot of credit because he became my mentor. And he really was the foundation of not only getting involved in missing person cases, but really changed my life in so many ways. So I have to give him a lot of credit. He's unfortunately deceased now. He passed away quite a few years ago, but his name was Joe Howell. So I reached out to him. I told him who I was, that, I had this dog, a German Shepherd, and I'd heard that you know a lot about tracking people, dead or alive, and I wanted to, you know, reach out to you and ask you questions on how to train these dogs and what's involved and things like that. Well, to my surprise, he agreed to meet with me. Please note that when I met him and what I had heard about him, I really expected him to be 10 feet tall and bulletproof. But when I finally met him, he was about my size, not much bigger than I am. But what he lacked in size, he really made up in personality and his confidence and his knowledge and skills in dogs. Probably the best thing that helped me with all of this was that I was young, dumb, stupid, naive, clueless is what I was getting myself into. I mean, that's the honest truth. If I really knew what I was getting myself into, I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to be out of my mind to do this. Well, that helped out a lot because he did a little demo. Zach was my dog at the time, and Joe ran off to go hide. And he said, I just want to see what your dog will do. Mind you, me and Zach had never done this before, and I just kind of looked at the dog. I said, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm going to have to follow you. You figure it out. So by just pure chance, he figured it out, and he found Joe, and he said, yeah, he seems to be a pretty nice dog. And I tell you what, I'll help you not only train you on how to train your dog, but I'll help you train your dog, but with the condition that you come out and lay tracks for my dogs. He had two dogs at the time, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's a great deal. So he and myself and others started working together. And what had happened is that the first time I laid a track was with his bloodhound. I have to tell the listeners this because they'll get a kick out of it. And it'll also explain, because I get the question a lot, why don't you use a bloodhound? Well, this is why I don't use a bloodhound. They're great dogs and they have amazing abilities, but I just prefer shepherds. So in this case, his bloodhound, he asked me to go hide. Well, I wanted to try, you know, to say, okay, I'm going to do exactly what he needs me to do. And I ran off into the woods. It was in the middle of the night and I'm lying there in the woods, you know, just waiting, you know, for them to show up. And I don't know, 45 minutes later, I hear this noise and this commotion. And imagine that scene in King Kong with the trees are parting. You can't see King Kong, but you can see the trees. You can see the bushes. You can hear branches cracking and breaking. And all of a sudden, this huge, god-awful, slobbery, smelly monster comes running toward me and basically just lands on top of me. And oh, it was comical because he smelled horrible. I mean, horrible. So, but he found me and, you know, we petted him and, you know, he was all excited about it. Well, I was an hour from home. I am not making this up, Laura. When I got in my car, I literally had to roll down my windows. I couldn't stand the smell of myself with that bloodhound slobber and just everything about them. They're great dogs, but just they have a unique smell about them. So that was my first experience with that dog. And then the second dog was his bite dog, which was Max, a black German shepherd. And let me just give you a words of advice. Again, when I go back, young, dumb, stupid, and clueless, this is where I am. When a police officer tells you, whatever you do, don't run and don't scream when I have my dog track you down, you don't just say okay and just run off like I did. You start asking more questions about why is that important to know. So I, of course, just run off and in the middle of the night, and I really wanted to try to impress Joe and the other officers. So I decided to hide under this tree that was like almost like a Christmas tree with the branches all the way down. So I'm lying on my stomach. It's in the winter. I'm wearing a heavy jacket. And I hear the dog and them running toward me. Then all of a sudden, I hear the dog coming under from underneath the tree. Then I'm hearing him sniffing right there. And now he's on top of me. And he's on my back. And of course, I'm expecting to hear Joe, you know, any second. I don't. And I'm lying there. And all of a sudden, what Joe told me, don't scream and don't run, is against every instinct that you want to do with a big black German shepherd on your back that you know is going to do something that you probably don't want him to do to you. So he's standing there on my back. And I keep telling myself, don't scream, don't run, don't scream, don't run. Well, he starts pouncing on my back because this is an experienced dog and he knows he can't do anything unless I react because I'm perfectly still. Well, he pounced on my back in such a way that it made me exhale deeply because he almost knocked the breath out of me. Well, that was enough movement for him to say, okay, you're fair game now. At that time, he bit down on my right shoulder, all four canines into my shoulder. I still am saying, don't scream, don't run. But what I did do is that I turned over and now on my back and I'm holding him at the scruff of the neck and he and I are eye to eye. And I'm still saying, don't scream, don't run. And I'm thinking, where is Joe? And all of a sudden, as this dog is about to do whatever to me again, that's when Joe yells, Max, no, and he pulls him off of me. That was my introduction to his second dog. Again, young, dumb, clueless, naive. Yes, I was. And I survived all that. And I have to tell you later on what Joe commented about that years later. To explain Joe and the other officers, mind you, I was a civilian at the time. And in law enforcement, there is something about, you know, being in the club. They really, you know, were apprehensive at first. But once they realized I was passionate, I was sincere, I was dedicated to doing this, they really became my brothers. They welcomed me with open arms and really helped me in this journey, and I had to give them so much credit. So years later, understand that Joe is one of those people, he has no filter at all. I can't tell you how many times after he and I did training, I would get into the car and I would be in tears because it was just, he said such horrible things and, you know, harsh things, and he didn't sugarcoat anything. And it was just something I was not used to. But years later, he came up to me and he said, "I tell you what, kid," and he would call me kid because he was much older than me. He said, I need to explain too. I was still not a police officer at the time. He looked at me and he said, "I tell you what, kid, I have been harder on you than anybody I've ever been hard on. And I have worked with a lot of people over the years in K-9 and law enforcement." He said, "But I've never been harder on anybody than I have you." He said, "First of all, I wanted to see how serious you were because you really didn't have a clue as to what you were getting yourself into. But also, I knew that you could handle it. And thirdly, you need to be tough in this world we live in and in law enforcement and public safety and finding missing persons and all of that. You really have to be tough to do it, and especially do it for a long time. So I hope you understand, you know, why I did it." And he said, "Having worked with you and others over the years, I would put you up against anybody, civilian or law enforcement otherwise." And that was the highest compliment he ever gave me. And he said, "If I had to choose anybody to watch my back or cover my back, it would be you. Because Tracy, you just have worked so hard, and I'm very proud of you." When I had started this, I was just so naive. This is not a glamorous life or choices that I make in finding missing persons. So it's really helped me in so many ways. One of those is just the mental part of doing this kind of work. But secondly, I found my calling. I found my passion in life, and that is public safety and finding missing person cases. With my experience, it really opened up my eyes on what I wanted to do with my life. And that's when I became a police officer and a firefighter, an EMT, emergency management, a K-9 master trainer, a ham radio operator, all of the aspects of public safety because I found my calling. So the question going back, did I intend or plan on becoming a K-9 handler and being where I am today? No, I didn't. I did not. But I'm so glad that I discovered that at such an early age. And I've had so many people help me along that journey. And it's been an incredible, incredible journey. And I'm so thankful for everybody that's helped me along the way.
I feel like every time we talk, I find out one or two more things that you've done. I know that also, in addition to training dogs for law enforcement, you also train dogs and other animals to work as service animals and even for Hollywood as Hollywood acting animals. How are those training regimens similar or different to training search dogs?
So when we look at dogs and their personality and temperaments, even when I'm testing a dog for myself or for others, for let's say specifically as a search dog, it's not the drives that I look at first. It's the core of who that dog is, the essence of who they are, their personality and their temperament, and what is best suited for their natural needs from a mental standpoint, physically, and the drives themselves. So when you look at service dogs, there are specific temperaments and personalities that are best suited for a type of dog that is a service dog. Same thing with dogs that are involved in production work and what we call Hollywood. I've seen some rock star dogs outside of a production set, but when you get them on production, it's a very, very different world to them. And some dogs are just not comfortable in that kind of environment. And then, of course, the search dogs or detection dogs, we have to make sure that they have a specific drives and personalities and temperament for that. Well, let's say we evaluate them as a search dog. Well, they have a lot of things going for them, but they may not have the drive or temperament for that kind of work. It doesn't mean that they're not a good dog or even a great candidate for something else. I have placed a number of dogs that I evaluated for search and rescue, but actually winded up being a service dog, and they were perfect for it. The way to describe when you look at working dogs and let's say companion dogs or family dogs, to really sum it up in one sentence is that a good working dog does not make a good pet, and a good pet doesn't make a good working dog. That's probably the best way to describe it. Specific dogs or specific breeds of dogs seem to excel at this. I mean, obviously, let's say for obvious reasons, a Pomeranian is probably not your first choice for search and rescue. So there are specific breeds that do very well at this. But I have to say that all of my dogs except one dog, I got just out of unusual situations, either out of a high kill shelter or maybe a dog that had, you know, maybe not perfect for a show ring or something like that. So regardless of where the dogs come from, you still want to look at whether they're a $5,000 dog or a $5 dog. It's not the price that you pay for that dog. It's more about who the essence of that dog is and finding what they're best suited for. And I've seen that across the board. When, again, we're talking specifically about search dogs, when we're evaluating those dogs, we look at drive. And one of the questions I get is that, how do you make your dogs do this? And the answer is, I don't. I really can't take much credit for these dogs at all. It's simply channeling those natural drives and instincts that they already have imprinted and ingrained genetically into them. For example, when we're teaching a dog how to track somebody down, they're in essence tracking an animal down. A human being is an animal. So instead of a rabbit or a deer, we're channeling that drive to hunt down something. And that prey is a human being. And when they find that person, it's a positive reinforcement to them. So the same thing with cadaver work. It's very similar to, let's say, a bird dog. So they're ranging and they're trying to find a specific scent that is not moving. It's just stationary. So drug dogs, bomb dogs, and cadaver dogs are all detection dogs. So it's not a matter of them knowing that they're finding drugs or bombs or even dead people. It's a matter of they're finding a positive reinforcement. So again, bird dogs, they want to hunt. And that's what detection dogs do. They hunt. So we just channel those natural drives to hunt something down, whether, again, it's bombs, drugs, or dead people. So when they find those things, they get rewarded. And that's something that I get a lot of people asking me, how do you make your dogs do this? And you don't. I'm really just the driver. I'm the chauffeur. I'm the cleanup crew. I'm the hairdresser. And I'm the chef. And I'm the maid. Everything else the dogs do on their own. And it's that bond and trust that we developed. And understanding that the dog is doing its job. And I do get the question a lot, how do I know when my dog is ready to do its job? And my answer is, you stay in the truck or you stay in your car. And they're like, what? I said, your dog should be able to know exactly what it needs to do completely without your input. In fact, most of the time we usually are confusing or do something that is in contradiction of what the dog is trying to do when we're working them. So these dogs, they're just, as much as I've seen them work and do the things they do, it's still magic to me. It truly is magic. And they do it so effortlessly. So I think that's something listeners might be interested in hearing about.
So this next question I feel is really related to that. How would you prepare a dog differently for searching, say, a natural disaster site versus for a missing person? And also tying into that, are some dogs specialized for a certain kind of situation?
Okay, so Laura, let's start from the basics. When we look at a dog and evaluate him for a specific job. So let's focus again on searching for live persons, because we have a lot of recent events with the condo collapse down in Miami and then these natural disasters that we have in the earthquake in Haiti. So those are disaster that involve an urban type of setting. Those dogs are specialized dogs, and they specialize in finding missing persons alive in these collapsed buildings, because we want to find as many people alive as we can and as quickly as we can. So when you compare that to that dog finding people, let's say in a wooded environment, again, just an area search, it can do that and do that well too. Now, what you can't do, and what I have seen sometimes, some dogs that work in a wooded environment, they are very comfortable and they excel at. But when you ask a dog that's used to working in a wooded environment to get on these collapsed buildings, some of them are very uncomfortable with it. So when we are training or looking and evaluating dogs for disaster work, we have to make sure that they not only find people with good drive, but they're comfortable and they have the agility and at a comfort level in being in that type of environment. And I have to address my own personal dogs. So I have a yellow lab, Chance, and I have a black shepherd, Draco, at this time. And then I just acquired a Malinois named Taz. So if you look at those three dogs, all three of them have great drives. They're great working in a wooded environment. They're you know, have all the things that you're looking for in a working dog. But if I put all three of them on a disaster, Chance and Taz, they're very light-footed. They're very comfortable and very agile. They're really what we call light-footed, that they can go from one area to another and do it very comfortably and very easily. Whereas Draco, he's got four left feet. He'll do it, but it ain't pretty, and he just doesn't like it. So we respect that. Doesn't mean that he's any less of a dog. It's just he's not comfortable with that type of environment. So it's a combination of not only recognizing that these dogs can work in multiple environments, but there are certain dogs that specialize in specific environments, such as a disaster. And then when we look at tracking somebody, a live person, Draco does live and cadaver, he's fantastic at it. So tracking a live person is, in essence, like following a rabbit or a deer. When we ask Draco to find somebody live and he's tracking them, it's what we call prey drive. He's a predator hunting down prey. It's a human being prey. Whereas when we ask him to hunt, which is his command to find dead people, a cadaver, that thing, with all respect, is not prey. He's hunting for something. For lack of a better example, it's like an Easter egg hunt. He's trying to find where that thing is. He doesn't know it's a dead person. He's just trying to find his ball, and we've imprinted cadaver scent with that ball. So it's two different drives, two different approaches, and two different outcomes. But again, if I get him on disaster pile, he just falls apart. So just understanding and respecting each and every individual dog and their strengths and weaknesses, that's our responsibility as dog handlers, to put them in these environments that they're going to excel at, they're prepared for, they're trained well for, but also looking at their personalities and temperaments, just as I spoke earlier. So I do want to add about cadaver work, because it's a unique situation. It is detection work, just like drug dogs and bomb dogs. And it's really interesting, the concept, when I'm trying to explain to officials or a DA's office or someone about how all this works. When I'm trying to explain how cadaver dogs work, it's really kind of an odd understanding or perception about them. But when I explain it from a drug dog perspective, people seem to get that, because drug dogs have been around a lot longer than cadaver dogs. So when we're searching, for example, if we're searching a car, we can't tell you what's in there, just as a drug dog handler can't tell you what's in there. He doesn't know if it's cocaine or marijuana or whatever it is. He just knows that his dog is alerting on scent at that car. It's the same thing with cadaver dog. So they're detection dogs. That's all they are. Now, from an evaluator's perspective, when I'm trying to evaluate a dog as a new dog, just like Taz, for example, I just got him a couple of months ago. Cadaver work across the board, the very first thing that I look at, of course, again, is the dog's personality and temperament and how they view the world. Is it a positive, you know, view of it? Because if you have a dog that has great, great drive, but it's scared of its own shadow, it's just not going to work. So once we know that the dog has the right personality and temperament for this, we expose them to cadaver scent. Because a lot of people don't know this, and your listeners might be interested in this. Some dogs have a natural aversion to cadaver scent. They literally are terrified of it. It's not a training issue. It's just one of those weird things. It doesn't happen very often, but I've seen it three or four times over the years, and it's obvious, and they literally are terrified of it. So it doesn't matter what kind of drives, temperament. It could be the most perfect dog, but if it doesn't like cadaver scent, it's immediately washed out as a cadaver dog. So there's so much more to it than just going out there and searching for someone.
So how do you train a dog to know and seek the smell of human remains?
Whatever the dog needs to be imprinted on, and when I talk about imprinting, it's a positive reinforcement, and we use toys as the reinforcement, that they're scented with a particular scent. And that could be anything from, again, drugs, bombs, even cancer, just whatever scent. Now, when we talk about cadaver scent, we're talking about human remain scent. And I want to emphasize again, dogs don't know that they're finding dead people. And I get that question that doesn't it make the dog sad? Doesn't it make them depressed? It absolutely does not, because they are looking for their toy. It's a very positive, rewarding experience for them to find human remains, even though it can be a distressing situation for the human counterparts of that. So specifically training a dog for that, we use like rags, for example, putting them in a body bag with a body. So that rag absorbs that scent. We don't have to have body parts. And I do get that. And I kind of jokingly is like, you know, guys, it's not like I have, you know, bodies hanging, you know, up in my garage or something. It's nothing like that. It's actually very clean. It's very safe for myself and the dogs. We don't interact with, you know, any of that kind of material. What we do is that it's all about scent. So we get articles, for example, let's say someone died in their home and in their chair, and we may ask, and they've been dead for several weeks in that chair. Well, that chair is going to be completely saturated with cadaver fluids. So we may ask them, you know, can we have the cushion to the chair? So we use that as a training aid. Another one, when I was working for the state, and people quickly learned, you know, the crazy gal that has the dog, she may ask you some strange things. And one of those is anytime an associate or coworker of mine was pregnant, or I found out, you know, she was pregnant, I would ask them, you know, I know it's a strange question, but can I have your placenta? And some people would say yes, some people would say no, and that's fine. So we use that as a good training aid for the dogs. So it's all about exposing the dog to that particular scent, which is a very unique scent that once you smell somebody that's deceased, it's something that you never forget. But to the dogs themselves, it is a unique scent. It is a scent that they can pick up easily and be trained on quite easily, and it's a positive reinforcement for them. And we start the training process of just throwing a scented ball, making it a very fun, happy experience for them. And again, going back to their drive, when we throw that toy, they want to go hunt for that toy. So when they pick it up, they inhale that scent, and that's what we talk about imprinting. And we just build upon that foundation until we get them to the point where they're actually alerting to the scent. And my dogs are trained to sit when they do find the scent. And it's that step-by-step process that we go through with them.
How close do dogs have to be to a decedent's remains in order to alert?
There's a lot of factors in that. And over the years, I have seen my own personal dogs, and I've heard of others, that can detect human remains some distance away. I remember one case in particular, we were about a quarter of a mile away from him, which is pretty remarkable, but the conditions were perfect. And let me just kind of paint the scene for you on what happened there. It was in the middle of the night. He had been missing, I think, 2 or 3 days, and he was an adult male. We were in a wooded, not mountainous area, but we did have some hills and valleys. As we're going down on the side of a hill, the dog starts showing what we call a change of behavior, indicating that they're picking up scent. What we didn't know is that the gentleman was literally across the valley from some distance from us on the side of the hill across from us. So it was almost like a parallel line that the scent had traveled from one side of the hill where he was on across this large valley to the other side of this hill where we were going down into. So it was pretty remarkable situation on the scent conditions and where he was placed and where we were happened just to be going down. So when we got down to the bottom of this valley, the scent had actually gathered because of the time of evening it was. And the dogs literally went from the valley up to the other hilltop or hillside to where the gentleman was. So that's a great example of a really long distance of picking that scent up. Whereas the opposite extreme of that, in certain conditions, let's say somebody that's been missing and presumed deceased for 25 years, and it's in August, and it's been hot and dry and dusty conditions, the dogs literally have to be really on top of where that person was buried, or even on top of where the remains are, even if they're not buried, to pick that up. One, the remains are bone, they're skeleton. The scent itself is very, very low, and I'll get into the thresholds in just a minute. But then the conditions themselves, hot, dry conditions, are just horrible conditions for scent. Think of scent as a living organism, just as we are. So scent itself, it comes to life, it has a lifespan, and then it dies out. So the scent of cadaver does last for many, many years, and the dogs can detect that, but it's the threshold that can be a real challenge. And what I mean by that is a great example is this. Somebody that's cooking a cake. So when you put the batter in, you put it in the oven, you really don't smell the cake at all. That's a very, very low threshold. So as the cake is cooking, you start smelling it just a little bit. Well, that's a medium, let's say a medium-sized threshold. And then when the cake is fully baked, that scent is literally filling up the kitchen and maybe perhaps most of the house. That's a high threshold. So when you compare it to dogs searching for cadavers or human remains specifically, because when we talk about cadaver dogs, most people think, all right, cadaver dogs, it's a body. Well, technically, that's not what these dogs do. They find human remains, and that's from skeletons all the way to a full-size body, and everything in between include dismembered parts. So these human remains detection dogs, or some people call them HRD dogs, they find that full spectrum of human remains. So when we talk about thresholds, the low threshold would be the bones and skeleton that have been there for many, many years. The medium would be, let's say somebody's been missing for several months, maybe 6 months or less, and we can't detect the smell, but the smell, you know, is still easily detected by the dogs. But then a high threshold would be a full-size body that's been missing, let's say, a week in an environment that accelerates the decomp that makes them really, really smelly, that even we can pick it up. It's like, well, that's a really strange smell. You know, where is that coming from? Even we can smell that. So that's the comparison of when we talk about thresholds in dogs, and we have to train them for those different thresholds. And getting back to your question, how close does a dog need to be to find someone? It has a lot of factors, including the thresholds of what they're working with.
Do you have to train dogs on how to work and identify remains in different environments, natural environments, swamps versus prairies, or are the differences intuitive to them?
Well, Laura, going back to what I said earlier about the thresholds, it's not so much about the different environments. It's more about, again, is the dog comfortable in that environment? And we talked earlier about working a disaster scene versus a wooded area. And the thresholds themselves, I would say probably when you compare those different areas you just described, swampy areas are a little bit unique. And we discovered this actually during the Tara Grinstead case, which was a very high profile case here in Georgia. It's what's known as the Beauty Queen school teacher case, because she was a school teacher, but also involved in pageants. So down in South Georgia, there was a lot of swampy areas and things that we had to check. Well, there's a lot of unique smells down there, gases, just an odd sense of the dogs had not smelt before. So that was a learning experience for me, and I have applied that experience in all the places I've gone. So, for example, it looks like I may be going to Nevada and or Texas here next month on two separate missing person cases. So not only do I do cases here in Georgia, and I do most of them here in Georgia or in Alabama just because that's where I live, but I've traveled all over the country and even the world looking for missing people. And from that experience, I learned wherever I go, I do actually some training sessions for the dogs. So they really acclimate to the environment and to the unique scents that they may have not been exposed to just because I live in the South. So things probably are going to smell different, you know, out in Nevada that they may have not smelt before. And it's a novelty to them. So it's a little bit of, oh, okay, that's something I can just put in my file. I don't need to really do anything about it. It's interesting. It's, you know, a curious smell, but I'm going to continue and stay focused on what I'm trying to find. So that's kind of a unique situation there. I do want to, and I just thought about this, people may not realize this, but something that I learned and I pass along to other folks, when we talk about dogs themselves, we talk about live persons versus dead people. And what is the difference to dogs? And this is the best way I can describe it. Death is life's perfect equalizer. What I mean by that is that when the dogs are searching for somebody alive, even myself, I have a twin sister, we smell totally different to dogs. And there have actually been studies that have been done with twins to see if dogs can distinguish between one twin or the other. And they do. So we all have unique individual scent that the dogs pick up and can distinguish among hundreds of other scents, including other people. Whereas when we're dead, we all smell exactly the same to a dog. So when you think about it, and I learned this from two cases years ago. The first case was a very bad part of town. It was a, you know, unusual, sad situation where this young man had made some bad choices in life and had overdosed. And he was in a very bad part of town. And just everything about it was really sad. The dogs reacted to him and found him deceased. Well, a week later, we go to this very, very nice area, these mansions, gated community. Unfortunately, it was during Halloween. They had candles in the house, and unfortunately, the candles caused the fire in this, I think it was like a 10,000 square foot mansion. And unfortunately, the grandfather didn't make it out of the house, and we found him deceased there. What was unique about that is that the dogs responded exactly the same way. These were two different environments, two different individuals, two different circumstances, two different demographics. It was just totally different for us from our perspective, but from the dogs, they reacted exactly the same to both of those cases. And that's when I had a light bulb moment and I thought, oh my goodness, we smell exactly the same to dogs when we're dead. So it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, rich or poor, young or old, it doesn't matter to dogs. And I just find that fascinating.
Our interview with Trace Sargent was so interesting and went so long that we don't want to cut any of the amazing information she shared. We'll be bringing you part two next week, where she discusses some of her most memorable water searches, the cases that drove her to start her own podcast, her dog's work on a 250-year-old case, and much more. You won't want to miss the second half of this interview. Oh, and don't forget to check out the Stitcher podcast app this week. It's Stitcher's second annual True Crime Week, and they're curating the best in true crime for you. You're bound to find new shows that you'll love. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard, begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show, and many other projects. You can read a public post about those goals on Patreon. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you'll get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters and Kim Fritz. Family interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please, join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.